is up? Welcome to NExpress, the Nintendo show of GoombaStomp.com. I am one of the hosts, Tim Mason. Here with me, I've got Ricky D.
What's up, Tim Mason? What's up, Nintendo Nation?
And I've got Patrick Murphy.
I am here too.
And once more, Zack Attack is back. That's right.
Glad to be back.
Zack the Rezack.
Do you know what I think of whenever I hear Zack Attack? Saved by the Bell. The band that Zach Morris was in called Zack Attack.
He named it after himself?
Well, of course he did. He was the greatest character in the history of teen sitcoms.
I never watched that show.
My friend was... Actually, I have two friends who acted in the show.
Oh, that's what? Fun.
You're kidding. Yeah, wow. No.
Well, they did reoccurring roles.
I probably know those characters. You know, I once recited the history of that show to somebody who was really bored while we were at work. And we had nothing else to do.
Okay, I don't want to mention names, but I've told you the story before, Patrick. When I was in college, I made a short film which won a bunch of awards, including Best Film and Best Actress. And the girl who auditioned for the role had never acted before. She walked into the audition room by mistake. And so I pretty much begged her to be in my short film because she looked right for the part and she was great. And so she auditioned. I decided, yeah, I'm going to cast her. We made the short film. She won Best Actress. Never even thought about being an actress ever in her whole entire life.
Really?
And her mom, like, that summer, was on an airplane flying to L.A., and she just so happened to be sitting next to a casting agent. And she's like, oh, wow, really? My daughter was in a short film. And she's like, maybe I should give you my... a copy of the film. And she didn't think that the casting agent would actually take the copy, but I guess because she made such a good impression on this lady, she decided to do it as a favor. She took the short film and she decided to hire her, and like within a few months she actually was like working in Hollywood.
Meanwhile, the people that put in the most work, you know, writing and directing and shooting the thing, got zero attention from Hollywood and are here with us today.
Hey, but I have four awards sitting on my shelf still. You know, I won Best Cinematography, nice. Screenplay, Best Short Film, and Best Direction. Yeah, I was voted most likely to succeed in Hollywood, as judged by like 700 students at Dawson College, and yet I never got into film school when I applied at Concordia University. So that was sort of heartbreaking and sort of changed my life. And I don't know why I'm talking about this on a Nintendo show, but anyways,
the strange paths that take us here.
Just think, if Rick had been in Hollywood and had married his true love of cinema and Nintendo, maybe we'd have some good Nintendo movies out there.
Yeah.
So we've got a really, really fun show, which I guess today is all about the future then, isn't it? So we're looking at one game that has been out for quite a while, but we haven't reviewed on the show, and Zach just did a review for us. That's Yooka-Laylee.
Yeah, Yooka-Laylee and the Impossible Lair. This kind of, I don't know if you guys remember the announcement, but it kind of came out of left field. Like, we weren't really expecting another Yooka-Laylee game. And then all of a sudden they announced The Impossible Lair, which is a 2D platformer instead of a 3D one, which, you know, when does that ever happen? Normally the nature of a sequel is to try to, you know, go bigger in terms of scope than the original, and going from 3D to 2D, I don't know if you guys would agree with me or not, isn't necessarily like increasing the scope of things, you know, it's normally thought of in the reverse. But I actually think after playing the game that was 100% the right move, because it's actually an incredibly polished 2D platformer, a super tight experience, very, very little amounts of filler, plenty of content, and it plays and runs great, which was a big complaint about the first game, was that it didn't run that well and that the controls weren't all that great. But this is pretty much the opposite. They've learned a lot about, you know, how to make a really good platformer since the first game.
You know, I think it kind of makes sense, even though it is sort of weird to go from 3D to, 2D or 2.5D or whatever people want to call it.
Right.
It's a side scroller. Because Playtonic, you know, is made up of a lot of former Rare guys, a lot of those guys, from what I understand, did work on the original Donkey Kong Country games.
Yep.
So just like they worked on Banjo-Kazooie. So it sort of makes sense for Playtonic to do something like this. They did their Banjo-Kazooie thing. Now they're doing their Donkey Kong Country thing.
Which I was always more of a Donkey Kong Country fan. Like, I like 2D platformers a lot. And this is just like really, really incredibly solid. They even had David Wise come back to do the soundtrack for the stages in the game. And, you know, the music is top notch. Grant Kirkhope also does the music for the overworld, which is actually really interesting because the overworld is a much bigger part of this game than people probably realize. Like, I would almost say it's like 50% of the game. Think of the overworld as a giant bird's eye view puzzle. And the more you solve this puzzle and mess with the environment and do all these things, the more opens up. And you'll spend a lot of time in the overworld, actually. I wouldn't say
good.
Yes, good thing. Great. It's a blast.
A good thing? Okay.
Yes, it is great. It's the puzzles are done well. I had just as much fun in the overworld as I did in the main levels. It's the game's made very well.
Well, I've had my eye on this one just because I like Tropical Freeze quite a bit. And how would you compare it to Tropical Freeze in creativity and difficulty?
Okay. That's a very good question, actually, because I'll do the difficulty part first. The entirety of the game is nowhere near as difficult as Tropical Freeze, except the very last stage in the game ramps the difficulty up to 11 and just hits you like a ton of bricks. So the way the game is set up is that there are 20 stages in the game, one alternate form for every stage, which is completely different than the regular version. So it's pretty much 40 stages in the game. And the impossible lair is the final level in the game. Now, this level can be tackled at any moment in the game, anytime. Even before you even do the first level, you can do the impossible lair. However, after completing each stage, you get an extra hit point going into the impossible lair. And if you count the ones in the overworld, it brings your total to 48 extra hit points. And even with 48 extra hit points, you will die a lot in the impossible. It's like a 20-minute long gauntlet stage from hell. It's got like four boss fights, four different full stages. It's crazy. And if you die, back to the beginning. So that part is really hard. That's by far the hardest part in the game. But outside of that, the large chunk of the game is fairly easy in comparison to Donkey Kong Country. Now, creativity-wise, it's a lot more basic, for sure. Donkey Kong Country is like if you took the spectacle of Uncharted and injected it into a 2D platformer, you get Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze. I mean, you remember how incredible the set pieces in that game are. You're not getting
there are a lot
of them. Oh, yeah. That's honestly one of the best damn 2D platformers ever made, straight up. But it's not quite to that level, but that's okay. That's not really what they're going for. They're going more for that original Donkey Kong Country trilogy, kind of simpler, you know, aesthetic. That's what they're going for, and they nailed it. So I wouldn't say it's like, I mean, even the fact alone that they borrowed so many ideas from the original trilogy, which is fine because it makes a really fun game, but I wouldn't necessarily call the game creative.
You know what is weird? Maybe it's just me, but I had no idea this game existed until I read your review. Like, did
a lot of people
marketing?
Said that.
Yeah, seriously. Like, I kept hearing about the impossible lair, and I thought it was some sort of like DLC level for the original game.
It's a sequel. And the announcement came out of nowhere, came completely out of left field. And then that was really it. They didn't have much marketing outside of that. They just kind of released this game, which is really, the first game had so much hype behind it. And I actually enjoyed the first game, but it does have a lot of flaws. It's just not as well made as The Impossible Lair. And it's a shame because if you even just kind of like platformers, you're really going to like this game. It's full of charm and full of personality. I don't know. It's a really, really solid game. Really solid.
And it sounds really solid. And I like
it.
It's super fun to have a game based on a 64 property I mean, like, clearly ukulele, even from the name, was always based around Banjo-Kazooie. It's fun to see them go even further back and return to Donkey Kong Country. That alone is such a selling point, and I'm glad that they actually were able to kind of recreate that retro magic that those
games they nailed
always
it.
Held.
They nailed it. For sure.
So exciting. So that sounds super duper solid. You were saying it's more like the originals again.
Right. Yeah. Definitely. It's much more similar to the originals than it is to the Donkey Kong Country Returns and Tropical Freeze, which, by the way, we still need a third game for that sequel trilogy, but that's a conversation for another day.
I don't think we'll ever see another retro game ever again, but, you know.
Well, I mean, we're getting Metroid Prime 4.
Are we, Zach? Are we?
That's fair. That's fair.
I mean, Nintendo was pretty clear about that. They weren't happy with where it was, and they had to hand over the reins to someone else.
Yeah.
It happens.
And I remember we talked about, Rick told me that whatever project they were working on in that 5-year span, that he, you know, will never see it, which is a shame.
Which I was right?
Who knows, Rick? Who knows? Nintendo is very weird, and they're unpredictable.
Who knows? Maybe we'll get another retro Donkey Kong title down the road. But
wait, guys, I'm a little confused here. You keep mentioning retro.
Yeah.
Like, why? Like, why not Rare? Why do you keep mentioning retro?
Because we were talking about the new Donkey Kong. We were comparing Ukulele to the new trilogy, which I wouldn't say it's that similar to those games. It's more like the older games in terms of scope.
Okay, that's what I was trying to figure out. So it's more like the traditional classic Super Nintendo, like Donkey Kong Country games.
Correct.
Which to me is good news. I love Freeze, but...
Right. So a lot of people are comparing it to Tropical Freeze, and it's more similar to the older game. Like, it's not like a huge spectacle like Tropical Freeze is. It's more of like simple platforming in well-designed stages, for sure. Don't get me wrong, but in terms of like scope and intensity, it's more like the older games, which is fine.
I feel like it's that unwritten rule in games journalism where you just have to compare it to the most memorable recent title. Even if it's not the best one, you're just automatically like, oh yeah, Tropical Freeze, remember that? That was good.
Yeah. Whereas
it could also be young bloggers or critics who maybe haven't played the older games but have played a recent game like Freeze. Maybe that is why? I don't know.
Yeah. That could be it too.
Maybe. I don't know what youth is going to get out on a retro-themed title like this. They're too busy with their Fortnites and their Minecrafts. Just kidding. So, like I said, we're kind of time traveling today. This week, we're all about looking forward, and that includes a very special peek behind the spooky door that is Luigi's Mansion 3. Patrick, you're reviewing it for the site. You can't actually give us your review, but you're allowed to give us a preview.
Yeah, the embargo rules just basically say I can't talk about any puzzle solutions or any levels past floor 8, maybe including floor 8, so I won't even bother with anything floor 8 and above. Guys, I really dig this game, though. I can at least say that. And unless it screws up, I'd say I'm about maybe 3/4 of the way through this thing. I have just a few more floors left to uncover, and I think I have 5 more bosses to go, but... Yeah, unless it screws up, this is going to rank a number 2 for me on the year. This is basically
I wonder what number one is. I really wonder.
I think everybody knows what number 1 is, and nothing could touch that. But
wait, I don't know what number 1 is.
Fire Emblem, dude. Fire Emblem.
Oh, boy.
Three Houses is my is
the
is
game of the year.
Second, yeah, it's a close second to Breath of the Wild.
Wow, I kind of feel dumb now.
Three Houses is the metaphor for our show at the end of the year when we're trying to decide the best game. And these two are like talking about the houses in Fire Emblem, and I'm going to be over here talking about Pokemon all by myself, like usual.
Well, Luigi's Mansion is a number 2 so far for me now. Like, I was kind of worried after, you know, I didn't like Astral Chain and Link's Awakening didn't exactly wow me. But Luigi's Mansion, to bring it back to that Luigi's Mansion 3, I should say, is basically, look, I'm a big fan of Dark Moon. I know a lot of people have their problems with Dark Moon, and from what I can understand, they stemmed mostly from the sort of the way the game, you know, is segmented. It kicks you out a lot of the time after missions are completed. You don't really feel like it's seamless in your exploration. And people didn't like that it wasn't just one house and it was broken up into different houses. I had no problem with that. I didn't like the getting kicked out, though. I can admit to that. But the gameplay for me of Luigi's Mansion 2 was so much richer than the original game. Even if the original game's environment, you could argue, was better. I will not make that argument, but you could make that argument. But the gameplay, it's no contest. Luigi's Mansion 2 is leagues above the original game in gameplay. So Luigi's Mansion 3 takes the great gameplay from Dark Moon and adds to it. It has all the good stuff from that game, but then it adds a lot of really, really clever mechanics, including Guigi, who has been revealed, who is my favorite mechanic for sure. Guigi, they have some very, very clever puzzles for him. And a suction cup that you shoot out that can, you know, say, rip off the cover to an electrical box or, you know, rip open doors that are locked or something like that. Because the suction cup has a rope attached to it and you can suck on the rope and yank it. So those are two of the best ones. So the gameplay is just like there's so much stuff to do that sometimes when I'm exploring, I sort of forget all of my abilities. And I'm like, I'm looking for a gem or something like that. And I'm thinking, what am I supposed to do to uncover this thing? And I have to sort of cycle through the Rolodex of all the things Luigi can do. It's not overwhelming, though. I don't want to give that impression. It's just like there's so much great stuff. And they've jam-packed this thing so, so full of secrets to uncover. And almost everything rewards you. And that's what I love most about Luigi's Mansion 3. Is there's a physics system in this game that is very different from any of the other games. There was, you know, some physics going on in the first Luigi's Mansion. Like you could suck, you know, the shower curtain and move it with your vacuum or, you know, whatever, things would flutter. And then the second one, obviously you could pull on tablecloths and whatever. You could shoot a rock, a piece of coal out of the end of the gun the vacuum and hit a target or something like that.
Someone's been playing too much Mario plus Rabbids.
Well, then this, yeah, exactly. This is a physics system where almost every object, and there are a ton of objects in this game, is subject to physics. And man, I got to tell you, I can't go, like, it's Nintendo said they can't spoil any puzzle solutions, but there have been so many times during this game where I just thought, like with Breath of the Wild, I wonder if I can do this. And guess what? They thought of that. And they reward you for thinking of that. And it's something completely off the oddball. And you're like, I just wonder. I'm going to play around a little bit in the little toy box that they've made for me. And sure enough, yep, there's a nice little reward for you at the end of it. And I just love that about this game. Every single, it's a fun house. There's so much stuff to do.
It's a ghost house, but go on.
Well, I will say this. The atmosphere is going to be closer to 2. It's still a little more cartoony. You're not gonna get this. Is a different setting. It's a hotel, and it's not a creaky, dusty old hotel that's been decrepit for years. There are the floors, as we've seen, are themed to, you know, they have different themes in every floor, and yeah, it does start out with sort of a haunted house vibe at the beginning, or you get kind of a, you know, I kept waiting for the a Shining reference that never comes, at least not so far, but it has that feel to it, that sort of like clean but creepy hotel vibe. Well, I shouldn't say clean because it's there are some rooms that look like Mario's room.
Two baby Mario, peaches.
There's a lot of pizza boxes in Mario's room. Let's put it that way. that guy's a slob. But the rest of the floors, they go on different themes, and I think I can talk about something like one of them's a shopping center, and you know, there's a killer garden kind of thing, and overgrown, like the entire floor. There's still rooms, but it's like it's overgrown with plants and grass, and it's really cool. There's some really cool stuff in there too. The way the grass parts when there are things in it, kind of creepy. They kind of find different ways to be sort of creepy, but it is more that Luigi's Mansion Dark Moon kind of cartoony creepiness. Not quite the, I guess it's not like Luigi's Mansion is really, the original one is really that scary or anything, but they played it a little more straight than Dark Moon did. Yeah, but anyway, I still dig the vibes. They've got a couple of jump scares thrown in there, thunderclaps. Luigi still is terrified, but it's all there's a lot of clever stuff in this. Right now I'm just finding it to be just like a pleasure to play through and discover all the puzzles. Like I'm probably spending too much time going for every gem the first time through, since I have to write a review for this thing. But I'll go more in detail when I actually review it, but so far so good, guys.
Oh, I cannot wait.
So we're going to talk about this next week when Tim and I play it. We're going to do a whole like full 45-minute review. But I've played the game, and I played it twice. And from what I've played, I love the game. I already know I'm going to like it. I'm wondering, how long do you think it'll take you or anyone to finish the game? And how are the bosses like the boss battles?
Okay, so I can talk about all this stuff. I am about 15 hours in, and I would say I'm about 3/4 done. I think. I mean, at least as with the number of floors that's on there. Now, 3/4 through the game, I have not, by the way, hard as I have tried, I have not collected every gem on every floor, though I have cleared some out. And I will be going back for them all. I guarantee you that. There was even one floor where I can see on the map entire rooms that I have no idea how to access. So I'm going to have to go back there. They were not necessary to beat the level. And I have not discovered very many boos yet. There are boos in this game, like there have been in the others. And so I know I'm going to have to go back and find these boos. Some of the puzzles are very devious, so I'm doing my best to like thoroughly go through the comb through everything, but you know, I also have to play it for review, so I sort of have to move on sometimes. All right, so the bosses. I'm going to tell you this. I don't remember. I've played through Dark Moon 3 or 4 times. The bosses were never troubling to me from day one, like except for maybe the last boss I can lose some energy on, you know. But for the most part, and same with the original Luigi's Mansion, never really that big of a deal. They were cool in the original Luigi's Mansion, and maybe not so clever in Dark Moon. I would say that as far as like people aren't going to be making up lore about these bosses like they did for the original Luigi's Mansion, you know, the little baby and all that kind of stuff that creep people out. And people like to sort of, you know, think about what was going on with the people who lived in that house. Again, these are more Dark Moon style, sort of cartoony. However, they are more challenging, I think, than any other boss in the other two games. I foresee people dying in this game. People who aren't, especially younger people, I should say. I foresee them dying quite a bit. I have died a couple of times on... There are a few, I don't want to get too far into this because this is actually past level 8, but there are a couple of set-piece rooms where there's some instant deaths involved if you don't get things right. And that's the only time I've died so far. But I have come very close on a couple of bosses, much closer than I ever came in Dark Moon. So as far as challenging goes, I would say they're kind of up there. As far as the franchise goes, as far as whether or not they're the most atmospheric bosses ever, I would probably say the original still has the best ones. But these, to me, they're fun and they fit the setting. They're better than Dark Moon's. You know, I think they're going to be more memorable than Dark Moon's bosses. They're just not quite as creepy and weird as the original games.
The reason why I ask is because I read an article with Kensuke Tanabe, who was, I think, the director of the game. I'm not sure if he's the director or if it's Ikebata, whatever, one of those two guys. And he was talking about how he wanted to put a real focus on the boss battles. And he said that there's two specific boss battles that are going to blow your mind. And
I think I know one of them, but I can't talk about it because it's later on. But there's one of them actually on floor 8, which Nintendo has said, I'm pretty sure I cannot talk about the boss at floor 8. That boss, yes.
Because I know there's like a dinosaur boss.
Yeah, the one they showed off at E3.
Yeah, they showed it in the trailer, so it's not a big spoiler. Yeah.
Which one was that? You mean like the T-Rex?
The movie set, yeah.
Oh, the movie set. Well, anyway, I'm not going to say anything.
Because the reason why I bring this up, and we really do have to move on, we'll talk about this next week, is because basically in the interview, he was talking about how he's like a fan of Japanese monster movies, specifically Godzilla. And so he requested from, I think it was Next Level Games or whoever, he's like, if I do this project, I want to be able to include like these bosses. So that's why he put a real emphasis on the bosses. So that's why I'm really excited to play the game. I mean, apart from the fact that it's Luigi's Mansion.
There are a lot of bosses, too. a lot. Like, so that's a good thing for people who like bosses. And a lot of them are just, they're super clever. They're the puzzles that you have to solve, it's not just typical stuff. You really have to, like, some of these bosses, I swear to you, I have had to run around and taking hits and avoiding stuff and thinking, what am I supposed to do here, until finally that aha moment comes when you're experimenting. This game really does want you to experiment with a lot of stuff, and it's pretty forgiving. Like, don't get me wrong, you're not going to just get mangled by these bosses and then kicked out and have to restart again. It's going to give you chances, but if you charge in there and just start doing stuff randomly without thinking, you're going to get wasted. You need to stay back and figure out exactly what approach you need to take. Observe. This game is all about observing your environment and observing the bosses and their behaviors. What am I supposed to do to get this thing to expose its weakness? And in some bosses, it's very clever, for sure. I've enjoyed the boss fights a lot more than I'm not really a big boss fight guy, but I have enjoyed the boss fights in this game quite a bit.
So this podcast is going to get released on the 24th of October. When does the embargo lift? Like, when is your review going to be published on the website?
The 28th is when the embargo lifts, so that's when I will have my review up. The game releases the 31st.
Yeah, I can't wait. Patrick is right. The Dark Moon is super good, one of the best 3DS titles ever, and Luigi's Mansion is one of my favorite GameCube titles, so I cannot wait for this. I anticipate it being one of my favorite of the year. I'm super glad that you're enjoying it, Patrick. Can't wait to read your review, and I can't wait to play it. But we should keep moving. We're going to keep looking forward, and with so much competition in the PS5 and Project Scarlet next year, what does Nintendo have to do to stay relevant, to stay competitive, and how does the Switch fare against such competition? We're going to discuss that in the next segment, so don't go anywhere.
Luigi and friends were invited to a special hotel getaway. So special. They may never get away. Find the courage and tools to save his friends from a hotel of ghastly ghosts. Find out in Luigi's Mansion 3 on Nintendo Switch, rated E for everyone.
Welcome back to N-Express. We're at our main event, a discussion of 2020 for Nintendo and the Nintendo Switch, when there's going to be a lot of competition on the market. We're going to have a new generation of consoles from both Sony and Microsoft in the form of the PS5 and the unnamed Project Scarlet. So we wanted to discuss what we thought Nintendo's best moves were to stay relevant, to stay in the people's minds and in the face of new hardware and presumably more powerful hardware, and what we want to see them do that we think will keep them in a competitive stance as they've been completely dominating with the Switch. So, Rick, this was your concept, I believe. Why don't you start us off with some of your initial thoughts?
Okay, well, look, the thing is, I'm a huge Nintendo fanboy. I think we all are, which is why we do a Nintendo podcast. I'm glad the Nintendo Switch is a huge success. That said, I'm sort of not worried, but I don't know, maybe somewhat worried, but more curious as to what Nintendo is going to do moving forward. Because the thing is, when you talk about competition, you got Apple Arcade, which is amazing. It's like $5 a month. It released with 200 games, I believe. The games on the service are incredible. They're getting rave reviews across the board. Then you got Stadia, which I'm not really worried about. I think it's going to be a complete bust. But it is Google, so who knows? They have all the money and the power to actually make it a success, even if it takes them like 4 or 5 years. You got Xbox, and what worries me about Microsoft is Xbox Game Pass, I believe it's called, which basically means that you get a bunch of games for free each month, including new releases like After Party, which is a new game from the guys who made Oxenfree, which is one of my favorite games on Nintendo Switch. It gets released this week, but it's on Xbox Game Pass. So, like, if you have the subscription with Xbox, you don't even have to buy the game, even though it's brand new. Then you got PlayStation And, you know, every time I'm watching TV, I see that incredible PlayStation ad in which all of the Sony characters, like the first party characters like Kratos from God of War or Nathan Drake from Uncharted or Crash Bandicoot, they all drop from the sky and land in some guy's house. And it's like an advertisement for their subscription service. And the thing about Nintendo is we have the Nintendo Online subscription, but like, let's face it, like we have Nintendo games and Super Nintendo games, and it took forever to get those Super Nintendo games. And there's just not much to play. And in terms of exclusives, we have Tetris 99 and I guess the Kirby game, and that is it. And so the thing is, as much as I love Nintendo, and I don't think you guys can argue this point, is a problem with Nintendo, it's a really expensive console. If I go out and buy my nephew a Nintendo Switch for Christmas, now I have the option between a Switch Lite and the Switch. So, okay, so at least they have the Switch Lite has an option now, which is great. But the Switch Lite is still a poor man's Nintendo Switch, right? So let's just say my nephew really wanted the Switch because he wants to play at home. He doesn't care about playing on the go or handheld mode. So a Nintendo Switch, even 3-4 years after the console gets released, is going to cost me $400 plus tax here in Canada. But then I have to buy a game, which is going to cost me $92. And I know the prices vary and are different in the States, but it's still expensive, right? And then he's going to want a Pro Controller, which is going to cost $90. The point is, it's a really expensive console. So the thing about Nintendo, what's strange about Nintendo, is a lot of their games and their system, it's aimed at a family and it's aimed at kids. But if I was like a parent and I had like three kids, and Tim, you can chime in next because you are a parent, and I don't have much money to spend, I can't necessarily afford to spend $700 day one on a video game console, and I'm a parent and I look at the options and I see the PlayStation 4 is on sale for $190, I can get Xbox for $200, I can get my kid a subscription to Apple Arcade for $5, or I can get Stadia, in which you don't even need a video game console. So I, as a parent, as a consumer, have to decide which one I'm going to buy. And at the end of the day, as much as we love Zelda and Mario and Fire Emblem and so on and so forth, money does talk. And one of our editors, who's a huge like fan of video games and Nintendo, he still does not own a Nintendo Switch. And he says it's because it's super expensive. Each and every single time when he wants to buy one of the exclusive Nintendo games, it's going to cost him $90, right? And so that's where I'm trying to figure out, like, what does Nintendo do moving forward in the next year or two? Because they're good up until 2020, hands down, right? I mean, the PlayStation 5 is getting released in December 2020, and I'm guessing the Xbox Scarlet is going to get released at around the same time, and Stadia will be out, and Apple Arcade, and all these other things. But what happens in 2020, at the end of 2020?
See, I think that there are some elegant solutions. And I think that Nintendo's kind of in a position that they could really combat people on whether they should pick up a new console specifically or a new service specifically. And I think that one of the best options for them going forward, especially in the holiday when those new consoles are dropping, is I think they've got to do some really, really tasty bundles. I think if you can pack a Switch in for people like Mike, you know, adult gamers who want to get caught up, if they could create a bundle that is the standard price of a Switch with, I don't know, Mario Kart, Zelda, Odyssey, and one other game, I think that that thing would sell out like hotcakes. They wouldn't be able to keep it on the shelves. If they really jam-packed it, just an insane bundle, I think Nintendo's true strength and where they're positioned right now is all in their library. They've got one of the best libraries in gaming. The Switch's library in the future will be fondly remembered when it's long gone as one of the best libraries, I think, with just Breath of the Wild, Odyssey, the games like Three Houses, just fleshing it out. It's honestly going to go down as one of the best remembered Nintendo consoles for that reason, I honestly think. So if they can get a lot of those games on a bundle for about the standard price, I think that would coerce a lot of people to avoid a new console, which is going to be $500+ in the US, especially when you consider all those accessories that you already mentioned, all those games. Then I think that they'll be positioned really well for the holiday.
We all buy Nintendo consoles for Nintendo games. But the thing is, like, what I don't understand, like I hate to compare apples to oranges, but like PlayStation, for example, you can play Last of Us right now for free, or you can buy it at Best Buy for $20 if you want the actual physical copy. Now, the thing is, the reason why they do this is because they want people who didn't pick up Last of Us at launch. They didn't pick up the game at launch. They didn't pick up the remastered version. Are they ever going to pick it up? Maybe we'll give it to them for free and or really cheap. So they might like the game and they'll go out and buy Last of Us Part 2. Nintendo never does that. They never drop the price of their games. And I get it. They don't necessarily need to because their games are fantastic. We, as Nintendo fanboys, we're just going to buy the same game over and over and spend like $10, $5, $20, no matter what the price is, to buy Super Mario World over and over and over again, or Legend of Zelda, whatever it is. But I'm talking about like the people who can't afford it. Like the thing is, like,
but Mike could afford it. He's just going to buy the PS5 instead. See, I think there's a big difference with people like him. Like, I don't think he counts, because you're talking about him not buying a Switch as his second console. Mike already has a PS4. So Mike has made his choice, and Nintendo's got to decide, like, are they the second console, or are we going to go after the people who haven't bought a console yet? Those are two very different markets, because, of course, yes, it's expensive to have two consoles. I don't. Like, I could easily say the reason I don't have a PS4 or an Xbox One is because it's too expensive. Like, the same rule applies. I only buy Nintendo stuff because having two consoles is expensive.
Mike might be a bad example, but I'm speaking about, like, friends that I have who have kids and whatever, and like their kids are asking for a console. When they go to Best Buy or GameStop, like, they don't know much about video games, but they see the price on the consoles. And I was talking to one of my friends just last week, and she's like, well, you know, the PlayStation was $200. You keep on telling me about the Switch, but Rick, the Switch is going to cost me $550 and there's no game. And I can't argue with her because it's her money. You know what I mean? Like, at the end of the day, the Switch is the most expensive console on the market.
Yeah, right now, until the new ones come out next year. But I mean, in which case, they'll definitely be more expensive.
And then the Switch will look like chump change comparably, yeah.
And that might actually help, though. So that you were wondering what Nintendo's strategy might be. Well, in 2020, they will be the cheapest console on the market. So it's possible that those same people whose kids want a console will go out and see the price of the PS5 and the Xbox. What is it called? Scarlet?
This is called Scarlet for now, yeah.
Yes. So they'll see the price of that, and then they'll see the Switch next to them, and they'll be like, well, and they can take this wherever they go, and it's cheaper. Maybe I'll go with that one. That's possible. I'm not trying to, like, I think you've got a good point. I mean, Nintendo has some real big questions because they're in this weird zone anyway, where their console isn't as technologically advanced as as the competitors. Like, you're talking about a PS4 and an Xbox One also that they're cheaper, and they are more powerful, which is a weird place to be for Nintendo. Like, that doesn't happen in technology very often, that something hot on the market is actually less advanced than the cheaper thing for them.
But the power doesn't bother me. Like the thing is, like okay, I'm sorry, Tim, but I have an Xbox One, and I'm not even entirely sure why I bought an Xbox One. It is, like, something I regret. I never use my Xbox One. I when I got the Xbox One, I thought it would have a lot of great exclusive games like Cuphead, and the only game that got released on Xbox One that I wanted to play that was exclusive was Cuphead, which, by the way, guess what? I'm playing on my Nintendo Switch, right?
That game is amazing.
Yeah, like, for me, I'm looking at the next generation, and I'm looking at PlayStation and Xbox, and I don't care how powerful or amazing the Xbox Scarlet is, I have zero interest in buying an Xbox, because at the end of the day, I'm buying a video game console for games, and I look at the PlayStation library, and I know I'm going to get a new God of War, a new Spider-Man, and, you know, all of these amazing, like, a new Uncharted, all of these amazing PlayStation games. That is the same reason why I buy Nintendo consoles. So it's not the power I'm focusing on, it's just that, like, Nintendo's going to go into, like, 2020, 2021, and all of these companies, be it Stadia, Apple, Xbox, Microsoft, Sony, they're going to be focusing really on some sort of streaming service. That is what Xbox is doing now better than everyone else. Well, better than Sony. They have their Xbox Game Pass, right? Everyone loves it. PlayStation dropped the price of their subscription. And so the thing is, again, yes, we all want to play Nintendo games, but if you, as a parent or a child or whatever, if you can buy this system and pay $7, $5 a month and get access to 400 games, or you can buy a Nintendo console, and yeah, you can buy Legend of Zelda and Super Mario, which is going to cost you $60 to $90 depending on where you live, but you're only going to get one game.
So I'm going to go ahead and throw my hat in the ring, because I want to make a clear distinction. Game Pass is very different than PlayStation Now and Stadia. And the reason why Game Pass is by far the best service in gaming, and I think we can all agree that, hands down, the best service in gaming, is because it's not streaming. That's why it's so good. You download those games natively on your system. Same with PC. Like, for example, The Outer Worlds is a Game Pass game. Comes out Friday. I have that already downloaded on my PC. I'm not streaming that game. I'm downloading it. As long as I am subscribed to Xbox Game Pass, you're playing that game well. Stadia, I agree with you, Rick. It's going to be a bust. It's not going to work properly. PlayStation Now is, in my opinion, the worst service in gaming. It does not work at all. Even with the best connection, it is an absolute atrocity to play even the simplest of games. It doesn't work. It should be completely free, because I can't believe anyone would pay any actual money for it. I don't think we're there yet with game streaming. Obviously, it's the future, and obviously they're still going to try it. But I just don't think we're fit. We're there yet.
The infrastructure is just not there for the majority of, like, the majority of Americans won't be able to successfully use stuff like Stadia.
Let's be honest. When has it ever worked? I've never ever streamed a game to something and have had a lagless experience. There's always some sort of latency. And for most of the games I play, like platformers, something like Super Smash Brothers, old school shooters, something like Super Hydora, something like that, you cannot have any lag at all. Even the smallest amount makes the game completely unplayable.
Maybe streaming service is the wrong word. I should be using subscription.
Okay. And that brings me to my next point. I agree with you. Nintendo does need, I would love for them to adopt something like that. Have a Nintendo Pass where you pay a monthly subscription and all the Nintendo first party games that come out, you can download right onto your Switch or whatever the next console is. That would be amazing.
We have a monthly subscription model, but you can't download the games, and there's not very much to play. And the
what
thing
do you
is,
mean?
I mean, you have the Nintendo Switch Online service, right? So you can play NES games and Tetris 99 and Super Nintendo games and a Kirby game, and that's it.
But those games aren't streamed to the Switch.
Okay, I know, but the point I'm trying to make here is that say they sell 40 million Switch units, right? I think they're at like 35 million. And you have like 30, 40 million people subscribe to some sort of service, but they're also incredibly happy with their service because they have access to all of these old Nintendo games and maybe even some newer games. I think a lot more people will go out and buy a Switch as their second console. And it would also help people who can't necessarily afford to pay $60 to $90 for one game.
Right.
Like, that's all I'm saying, because times are changing. And to me, it's not, everyone focuses on the power of the console.
That's consumers what's so, care.
Right.
They always have cared. They always cared about what the shiniest graphics are. And everybody's always, like, we can't say that that's not a factor.
Right, but
it's always been a factor.
That's what makes Xbox so cool right now, though, Rick. You were explaining, they don't have many exclusives, and I get that they don't. They just recently purchased a bunch of first party studios, so you know that's more the exclusive thing is a future project for them because they're making up for lost time, which was the disaster of the original. Here's the thing. What makes Xbox so cool is they don't even really care if you buy their console anymore. All they care about is that you're a part of their ecosystem, whether that's Game Pass, you know, for example, I love Microsoft. I don't have an Xbox. I have Game Pass on PC and it works flawlessly. It's amazing.
That is why everyone loves this Xbox subscription model.
But to Nintendo's credit, and I mean, maybe this is not the right time to bring this up, but not everyone can afford to subscribe to something like Game Pass, which isn't really as killer a deal as a lot of people make it out to be. Like, I have it right now because I had a bunch of sweet deals.
I disagree, man.
It's $15 a month.
No! Whoa. That's for the most expensive one. I pay $5 a month for the PC version.
Exclusively for PC.
Right, but so say you only have one platform. It's going to be less than $15.
So, Zach, you pay $5 a month, and how many new games can you play this month?
I would have to look at the list, man. There's well over 100 games on Game Pass for PC right now, and The Outer Worlds is a $60 game that I'm going to be able to play on Friday. There are some games that are only available on the Xbox platform. They're trying to move stuff to PC, but any game that's going to have a simultaneous release, which is most of them, is going to be on both. Like Gears of War 5.
Do you think that $5 a month for a system that releases that has over 100 playable games on it is actually going to be profitable? You know, there was a thing called Movie Pass. It was a great deal for everybody. All you got to do is pay $100 a year and you can go see as many movies as you want. And guess what? It went completely bankrupt because that's not sustainable. It's not feasible to make a profit on. Now, it's one thing to want to lure people in with cheap prices. Is $5 a month really going to, like,
absolutely,
how do you expect big budget games to actually be able to survive on the minuscule? I don't care if 40 million people subscribe. Right. Like, 40 million people buy Grand Theft Auto, right, at full price. So I think the profits aren't necessarily in a system like that, and that's what Nintendo is looking at. What are we going to make the most money on? Now, it is one thing for a company like Microsoft, who has its fingers in all sorts of other things. The gaming department is not, like, the most profitable department at Microsoft. So they're able to take – they're able to try out things where they can lose money in order to get – consumers, right, to get people over on the side, to build that economy,
to build that system. Look carefully at, like, Zach's pricing, not to, like, pull the rug from under you, because it is a killer price for the PC right now, but this is what I'm saying. As, like, a console gamer, I can't have Xbox Live and have Game Pass on console without paying the $15. Like, right. I could just have Game Pass for $10, or I could have Xbox Live for the $5 a month, but for both of them, it's $15. If you look at the PC, the introductory price is $5, but it will go up to the $10 eventually.
It will? Are you sure about that?
It's even got, like, on their marketing, they have the $9.99 or whatever crossed out, but it specifically says in parentheses introductory price, which means that down the line, you can presume that the price is going to go up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those things where they hook you, and then you don't want to get rid of the service because then you lose all of those games. So at what point is it profitable for gamers to really have those? Because that's a fee that you can't go without paying, right?
Right.
So I think maybe the solution here is Nintendo does have a system by which they make the price of games cheaper. They have the Nintendo Classics or whatever they call it. And maybe they just need to introduce that faster, maybe because games are getting churned out so much faster and every other competitor's games become cheaper so much quicker. Maybe Nintendo just needs to focus on getting their signature titles to be a little bit cheaper faster, because then Breath of the Wild and Mario and Mario Kart will all be probably $20 based on trends. So maybe it's just a system by you sign up for that and you get to download all those for $20. But it's earlier? I don't know.
But at the end of the day, you are still paying $15 for your Xbox Pass, right? You are doing it. And the thing is, it's like, I understand what Patrick's saying. Clearly, they're not going to release Breath of the Wild 2 for like $20 to put it as like a free game part of the service. But they do have this incredible library of GameCube games, N64 games, Super Nintendo games, etc., etc. And we have some on the Nintendo Switch, but not many. And the thing is, like, there are companies out there that they make money selling these modded, like, Game Boy consoles or Game Boy Advance consoles, and it's because people just want to play these old games. So it's like Nintendo can do the exact same thing and just have them available on a system like the Nintendo Switch. Anyhow, I think, like, at the end of the day, the Switch is doing great. I'm not worried about 2020 and 2020. Like, I think, like, we all agree that Nintendo doesn't directly compete with Microsoft or Sony. In some ways, they do, but it's like their games are so different, and it's like people who haven't, like me, I have a PlayStation and Xbox, and I wouldn't say that my Switch is my secondary console. It's kind of like in reverse because I'm a Nintendo fanboy. But a lot of people I know, yeah, they do have a Switch as a second console. But I don't know, man. It's just, I feel like the whole video game landscape is changing. And, like, I'm just wondering what it's going to look like for Nintendo, like, moving forward, like, past 2020.
They have to differentiate themselves like they did with the Switch. I mean, their console, I mean, you're right, they don't directly compete because they have a handheld console, essentially. I mean, yes, you can play it on TV, but its big selling point, as we've seen with the Switch Lite, is that it's handheld. So they're sort of off on their own thing. I think their only way to compete from now on is to not do what their competitors are doing. Although I do agree with you, having that back catalog on Switch Online, the GameCube, N64, everything, like, they should make that a priority, because that would really tempt a lot of people. It would draw a ton of people in, nostalgia-wise, especially those people who are, you know, starting their own families, and all of a sudden Nintendo comes out with this console that has all the great games from their childhood. I think that would be huge. They really need to make a priority getting that back catalog on.
And as someone who does collect and has all of the classic consoles so far, I don't know about you guys, but having those same games on my Switch is so much more preferable and convenient that I don't care about an N64 classic anymore. I kind of just want those games to be on the go on my Switch at all times. Cause there's a lot of games I want to revisit that I frequently want to revisit. And, you know, you get that itch and you can't do anything about it right now, conveniently.
I totally agree. I bought the Super Nintendo Mini and I've touched it once, because now all the games are on the Switch, and like, it's such a hassle to hook up the machine. But here's the thing. With the PlayStation 5 announcement, the thing that most people are excited about, and I think IGN did like a reader's poll, and I think it was like 85% of people said that this is the thing they're most excited about, it was the backwards compatibility, where it's backwards compatible. But the point is, you have some sort of like service, like what they have now, but all of those older games are available. The games from GameCube, 64, NES, Super Nintendo, you name it. To me, that's a major hook.
And the Wii. I mean, get the Wii games on there too. Like, yeah, that's a huge deal. If you could go back and instantly have Mario Galaxy at least to play on your like, that's it's something they really, really, really have to make a priority on.
Yeah, because they can re-release Mario Galaxy and say maybe sell 5 million copies on the Nintendo Switch, right? For sure. But if they, again, if they, and even if we had to pay a little bit more money, if we're paying, say, like $10 a month or $7 a month, whatever it is, for this Nintendo service, and all of those games are on the service, at the end of the day, I think they're going to end up making more money. Like, I think.
That's what they have to weigh. They have to weigh, okay, do we put these all on a service in order to get more people buying Switches, hopefully, or do we sell 5 million cartridges at, you know, $60 a pop and rake in $300 million on a, you know, an HD upgrade of Mario Galaxy? You know, that's the kind of decision that Nintendo has to make. What is more profitable for them? They're not going to get any new consumers having an HD, or sorry, any new Switch owners having an HD Mario Galaxy, but they're going to make a lot of money. However, put that on a service and you may actually draw a bunch of people in. It's hard, you know, I'm sure they've got people talking about this.
Oh, I know. There's so many people analyzing and trying to figure out what the best solution is.
Well, you know what the funny thing, Patrick, is? If they release a Mario Galaxy, like a special remastered edition, and it sold 3 million copies at $60 a pop, that comes to $180 million. Now, if you have a subscription service and you have 30 million people subscribing at $5 a month, that comes to $180 million. At the end of the day, you made the exact same amount of money, but you didn't have to remake the game and port it to Switch.
True, but you did it with more games. So what if you not only sold Mario Galaxy, but then also Mario Sunshine, and then also Twilight Princess, and you sold each one of those individually? Now all of a sudden you're talking about potentially, you know, $1 billion versus $180 million, where all those games are all located in one subscription. That's what Nintendo has to sort of figure out. And right now it seems like they're leaning more towards, hey, we'll just do things individually because that nets us the cash. Now, I don't know if it'll help them in the future. I mean, I think subscription models, you're right, they are going to be a big part of gaming's future. Nintendo does need to get on board, but they also need to figure out what sort of works for the Switch.
This holiday, here's what you do, Nintendo. You ready? Release a Nintendo Direct. It opens with Mario in Peach's Castle from Mario 64. He runs, he jumps into a painting. What's the painting? Nintendo Switch Online. The world loses their minds. Then at the end, you have Mario shooting out of a star cannon from Mario Galaxy. What's he shooting to? Nintendo Switch Online. People will be so stoked.
And then they'll release Mother 3, and then Half-Life 3 exclusively for the Switch.
And then Metroid Prime 4 is real and coming.
Riddle me this. Nintendo releases, like, a Switch Lite or, like, a mini version of the DS or whatever. They always release these, like, cheaper models of, like, their consoles, right? Because they're concerned about the families who can't afford, say, the original Switch.
Right.
But they don't do that for their video games. So it's like, yeah, we're going to give you the console. It's cheaper, even though it's a poor man's Nintendo Switch, but you're still going to have to pay $60 for each of our games. Because, yeah, we know you don't have money, but we're never going to drop the prices, guys. Well, that's I'm just saying.
That's what the bestseller thing is for, I guess. I mean, it's like $20 cheaper, if I remember right. Aren't they usually...
They're typically $20 a pop.
Okay. Oh, that's right. $19.99. You're right. Yeah. So, I mean, that's what their greatest hits thing. You know, you're going to have to wait a little bit for that to happen, but it does happen during the console's life cycle. yeah, I don't know. I definitely see what you're saying. I can also see Nintendo doing something different and thinking that it might work. The problem with stuff like this is you never know what actually will work, because the market is going to push and pull in ways that we can't comprehend right now. And
companies are
the ones that adapt quickest.
You remember how many articles there were about the Switch before it came out, and essentially doom and gloom for Nintendo, and then it literally broke like every sales record you can possibly imagine.
Nintendo
has hilarious.
Died and been resurrected so many times.
I know. There's been so many Nintendo's dead posts. It's ridiculous.
Well, look, their answer to PS5 is simple. It's Zelda 2. If they can get Zelda 2 out by next year, which is possible.
Same day. I want them to same day it. Just yeah. For fun.
Honestly, that would be amazing.
This is probably the least worried I've ever been going into the next console generation, because Nintendo really is in a market of their own kind of thing now, like more than they've ever been, in my opinion. And I'm not interested in a more powerful box. And that's what Microsoft and Sony are selling, is a more powerful box.
I don't think the differentiation of the market for them is any different than before. It's just that people bought into this market. So yeah, I'm not worried about it. I'm excited about it, though. No matter what, I think things are looking bright, and it should be a fun transition for everybody. Speaking of, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to investigate the darkest timeline, looking at some fun dark games, so don't go anywhere. Welcome back to N-Express. We're at our final segment, a discussion of two darker-themed games. We've got The Return of Oberdin, which Ricky has been playing for us and has some thoughts that might not match up with what the general public has been thinking. And we're also going to talk about Dark Devotion, the latest in, I don't know, a long line of dark-like games, I think is what we have decided these are called now, Souls-like.
Yeah, Souls-like. I guess you could something call it like that. Yeah.
Yeah. This kind of fits that bill. And Zach, you played that for us.
Yeah.
So why don't we start with The Return of Oberdin, though? Rick, what do you think about this?
So exactly 1 year after it was released on PC, it finally docks on the Nintendo Switch. And I went in and I did not really know what to expect. But this game, it's tricky because this game is amazing. Like, it is honestly incredible. And if you like puzzle games, and if you like whodunit detective noirs, if you like H.P. Lovecraft, I would recommend it. But the thing is, it's not a game I would recommend to the average Joe, because I would be like afraid that I would recommend this game and someone would be like, oh, this game is so stupid. It's like a walking simulator and there's like no cutscenes and like half the time the screen's black and the graphics suck and like you don't do anything. You know what I mean? Like, it's not
that,
like
that's me right there. He's talking about
yeah. Like, so this is from the designer Lucas Pope. He developed that game Papers, Please, which was like this huge hit a few years ago. And it really is quite unlike any game I've played before. And it's weird because imagine if Christopher Nolan decided to make Clue, but he was influenced or inspired by H.P. Lovecraft. Like a movie like Memento, it runs backwards. So you actually start at the very end of the story. And there's 10 chapters. You start in chapter 10. And you have to work your way backwards, like Christopher Nolan's Memento. And you have to try to figure out what happened to 60 people who boarded this ship called the Obra Dinn, which vanished 4 years prior, then magically reappeared, but now everyone on board is dead. So it's just really dark, twisted, detective whodunit horror.
That sounds crazy.
Thriller. Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, so you have to solve this large scale mystery layered with eccentric personalities, ulterior motives. This is a game that doesn't just have a twist ending. Like the entire like structure of the game is just sort of like mind blowing. Like I can't even imagine how he went about making this game. I kind of feel like he had to make the game backwards. So it's really, really interesting. But the thing is, like, again, I don't know if you guys would like it. Like, Tim, I don't think you would. Patrick, maybe. So basically, you play as an investigator, right? You're not really a detective. You're an employee of the East India Trading Company. So you're sent to investigate the ship, the Obra Dinn, which, again, was lost at sea in 1803, has reappeared 4 years later, and everyone on board is dead. And so you have to try to figure out what happened to the 60 people on board. Now, in order to accomplish this task, you're given a notebook, and the notebook basically contains sketches of the crew and a manifest of everyone on board. So basically, there's like the crew and there's the passengers, and the notebook gives you little details about each person and a sketch. But the sketches of all of the characters are somewhat blurry, so you can't really make out who's who. So we do know everyone died, right, on board. So it's up to you to fill in the gaps. But you're also given a pocket watch. Now, the pocket watch allows you to rewind time. So whenever you walk up to a dead body, you can use this magical pocket watch called a memento mortem, and you can rewind time. So it's sort of like, Tim, you've played The Sinking City, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, in that game, the detective Charles Reed, he has the mind's eye. So the mind's eye allows him to peer through the fabric of reality, and you can basically witness the final moments of someone's life right before they die. It's the same sort of concept, but you're using a pocket watch. So you basically walk up to all these dead bodies and you have to investigate these visions in order to move on to the next step of the mystery. And as you watch the story unfold, you watch everything in reverse chronological order and you see the final moments of the men and women who died on the ship. It's kind of like a brilliant concept. And the whole time playing this game, I kept on thinking, man, I want to turn this into a movie. Like, this would be like such an amazing movie. Again, I do not know if I would recommend it as a game, though, because it's actually super, super hard. I think someone like Patrick would do way better playing this game than someone like me, because you're better at puzzle games. You love puzzle games. I was just like, it took me forever to figure things out. It's actually super hard. You have to really pay close attention, because every time you get one of those flashback scenes, everything is a clue. It could be a noise in the background. It could be a line of dialogue. It could be a sound effect. It could be something hovering in the back. Like, there's clues in every frame. And so you have to pay super close attention. And sometimes you have to, you know, wait until you see like three or four of these visions of the past in order to figure out someone's name. Because you have to figure out, there's 60 people, guys, 60 victims, right? You have to figure out all of their names, how they died, and who or what killed them. So 60 people, who are they? How did they die? Who killed them? It's wow. Not easy. It's not easy. You guys have seen Clue. You've played Clue. So in Clue, there's always one person that dies. Who killed whatever? Miss Scarlet. How did she die? What was the murder weapon? In which room?
Colonel Mustard. The pipe.
I think in this case, it's most appropriate to say Colonel Sony with the PS5.
In the butler's pantry.
Yeah. Guaranteed. So in this game, you have to figure out how all 60 people died, who killed them, and with which weapon. it's mind-blowing. Like, this game is really, really something truly special.
I saw Mark Brown, the Game Maker's Toolkit guy who does, boss keys and stuff on YouTube. I saw him do a thing about this, about detective games in general, and he pointed this out as being an example of a really good detective game because of the way it distributes its clues and it doesn't really lead you anywhere. You really do have to figure things out. So that's what had me intrigued about this game, because I do like stuff where I have to pay attention, where I have to be hyper aware of everything, and where the tiniest little, like you say, a sound could lead you to infer something else. I do like stuff like that.
Yeah, and the whole point of the notebook is, so whenever you see one of these visions, so you have a flashback, right? So let's say, for example, someone knocks at the door, guy opens a door, someone has a butcher knife, the other guy has a gun, you hear a gunshot, you hear someone in the background scream someone's name, right? So every little clue gets entered into the notebook. So you basically go to the notebook and you flick through the 120 pages of this notebook, like this journal, and you have to sort of like look at the clues, and then you have to try to decide, who is this person? Who killed them? How are they related to this person? You know what I mean? So it's just like, it's such a unique game. It's a game I admire. It's not as fun to play as, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a really good detective game right now.
Are there any good ones?
Detective Pikachu.
LA Noir? Was that any good?
Captain Toad Treasure Tracker.
Yeah. Well, no, I was going to mention The Sinking City, but like, I had problems with that game. Anyhow, it's like, I recommend this game if you like puzzle games. And a lot of people are like turned off just by the art style, because it has this monochromatic look. And I think the actual game developer describes it as like one bit. But I kind of like the art style, because the game takes place in 1803. And the art style, which sort of like reminds me of those mono monitors like IBM or Commodore, like how games used to look back in the days, it also looks like the sort of sketches that you would find from like 1803. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if you find a sketch of someone who lived in 1803, like, the sketches sort of look like resemble the art style of the game. So, I don't know. Oh, by the way, the best thing about this game, the best thing about this game, this game has one of the greatest soundtracks ever for a video game. And it's actually composed by Lucas Pope. So he actually also did the music. He wrote the script, he developed the game, and he did the soundtrack. Like, this guy is a genius. Do I like this game? Yes, I admire the game. I love it. For me, it's just really, really hard. I haven't finished the game yet. And apparently, there's multiple endings.
I mean, I just think, I've thought it looked cool for a long time now. I was going to wait to see what you had to say about it, because it sounded like maybe you were super sure about it at first, but... yeah, I like the way it looks. And I think the idea of it being sort of like a mystery movie is a good thing, too. I think you could do this alone and get entertainment out of it just from, you know, if you like mystery movies and solving those things, or reading a mystery novel. And yeah, I like the idea of seeing a mystery novel come to life, essentially. See, the thing is, like, I understand why some people may say, oh, it's a walking simulator and you don't do anything except for the puzzle part. Like you said, this is a puzzle game and you have to figure out the who everybody is, what they were, or what they died of, and then who or what did it to them. Like, that, to me, that is what differentiates it from a walking simulator. You're not just walking around watching everything take place. You are an active participant in this story. That's what I like about it.
Anyhow, I think the game is close to a masterpiece. Like, regardless if you play this game and you don't enjoy playing it, I think you have to admire what this guy did. Like, this, like, independent video game developer who pretty much did it all himself, and just the concept around it. It's really, really, really fascinating.
Yeah, it sounds like the production is like nothing else, and it looks really, really distinct and unique.
Yeah,
so I really like that. We have Dark Devotion to talk about as well.
Dark Devotion.
So I think, Zach, are you the only one that's been playing this? Has anyone else been playing Dark Devotion at all?
No, it's not out yet. Oh. It gets released on Switch this week, but Zach's played it on PC, I believe.
Yeah, it came out on PC months ago, but it's coming out on PS4 and Switch soon, I believe. this is a really, really cool game, and it is definitely one of the most depressing games I've played recently, for sure. It's like the whole game, like it, you know, it's very easy to call certain games dark, like you call Majora's Mask is a dark game. Every moment of this game is dark and mellow and sad, pretty much. It's not, there's not any, you know, gleam of hope or anything like that. And it wears that aesthetic very, very well. It's a slow-paced, methodical side scroller in terms of combat. So obviously there's going to be a lot of comparisons to Dark Souls, but I'm going to try to kind of avoid doing that as I talk about this game. But I've heard it referred to as like a roguelike or roguelite, and I wouldn't necessarily say it kind of is, but it isn't. The only thing that's randomly generated about this game is the item placements. The entire structure of the map, which is one big map, it's just one giant map that you work your way down. And that's all set in stone. Enemy placements are the exact same every time, including the actual enemy that appears. Bosses are in the same spot. So there's not much randomness to it, but it is a game that takes place in the form of runs. Like when you die, you go back to the hub world. You can have different loadouts and stuff like that that you'll unlock as you kill more bosses and stuff like that. So it's formulaic and interesting in that sense, but I think the gameplay works well. It is very unforgiving and very punishing, and it might take a while before you feel like you're making real progress, but I think it's definitely worth it if you want to stick with it. There are some really cool boss designs in this game.
You release a very dark, brooding, medieval-themed, slow-paced, methodical boss fighting game like this.
Yeah, it's more it's like, of it's like hard a
comparison.
Yeah, that's true. But there's no like Dark Souls doesn't take place in the form of runs through one giant map with like similar starting points and stuff like that. It doesn't work kind of like that. There's no there's not really any leveling up per se at all, and like stats really. It's more just like you take like you are what your gear is kind of thing. By design, the game is tough. Like by design, yeah.
Because it looks great. And I actually have a review code of the game, and I'm not entirely sure if I want to play it, because like I said, right now I just do not have time for a really, and I don't have the patience for a really tough game.
I really hope someone takes that code though, because it's a great game. It's fun.
Well, like Salt and Sanctuary was a game that got compared to Dark Souls, but to me it resembles Castlevania, and it's one of my favorite games on Nintendo Switch. Is it hard? Yeah, but it's not too hard. But I don't know. Anyhow, it does look good though, and it comes out this week on Switch.
It's definitely, you know, a game called Blasphemous just came out, which is funny I'm even mentioning this, but it is a very blasphemous game for sure. I mean, there are some very, it deals with very serious religious themes, and gods, killing gods, stuff like that. So it's actually kind of similar in tone to Blasphemous, I would say, just from having seen kind of what Blasphemous is. But it's a much slower paced game than that, which is fine. But there's some really, really interesting boss designs here. The environments are really cool and stuff like that. And there are certain modifiers like curses and stuff that can be put on you that make the game either easier or harder as you go through. And those are kind of randomly generated as well. So definitely don't think of this as something like the Binding of Isaac level of randomness, because it's not. The game is handcrafted. Everything in terms of the design of the world and the enemies is placed there for a reason. But I think they did a really good job. So anyone thinking about getting that, I would highly recommend it. And I kind of wish it came out on Switch when it came out on Steam, because this is a game easily I'd rather have it portable. Easily. No question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, before we close, because we do have to close, we should just mention that every game we reviewed today, we played on Switch except for Dark Devotion, which you played on PC, so
yeah, I can't speak on the Switch or PS4 ports of the game. I highly doubt there's going to be issues, but you know, knock on wood, I can't imagine there'd be.
No, I highly doubt it too. that does it for our show. Zach, thank you for being here once again.
Thanks for having me.
Where can we find you online?
So please check me out on my YouTube channel, RackZzak64. I am uploading more frequently now. I'm trying to find ways to do, you know, more casual videos in between the high effort under the radar videos. I have a really cool video plan for like my next video essay video down the line for Under the Radar. It's going to take a lot of effort, but it's on a really cool game that I think a lot of people probably have never even heard of that's been out for a while. But please follow me there. Subscribe if you can, because I'd love to have more people. It's a very small channel right now, but I'm, you know, trying to put a lot of work into it. And as always, if you want to see my written stuff, I'm always on goomastomp.com.
And Patrick Murphy, when you're not traveling through haunted hotels, where can people find you?
Now I'm always traveling through haunted hotels. In fact, I'll be doing that as soon as we end this podcast. But otherwise, I guess you can find me at goombastomp.com, where I will have a review of Luigi's Mansion 3 on October 28th. So look out for that. Plus, of course, always pay attention to Sword Cinema, the movie section, because there are a ton of movie reviews going up all the time of both big movies and little movies. Sometimes the smaller of which are the better. Yeah, check it out. Oscar season is coming up. I mean, come on. Just like in the movie spirit. Plus, oh, we're doing our whole month of horror thing, too. I mean, there's lists that Rick has published of the greatest horror movies ever made, and you've got, like, the best giallo movies ever made for you, for those who are into the Italian horror. There's tons of great stuff on Sword Cinema for Halloween horror movie buffs.
Yeah, I just don't know that I always agree with Rick's taste.
It doesn't matter whether or not
Texas
you agree.
Chainsaw, really, Rick? Texas Chainsaw.
Whether or not you agree with Rick's taste, that is the most comprehensive. The man is a library for me. So it's the most comprehensive list you'll find ever. And you
borderline broken inside with how many horror movies he's seen.
My list of the greatest horror films of all time, actually that's of the 20th century, is based on not necessarily my personal favorites, but really thinking about the movies and the impact they had on the genre and how they influenced cinema and filmmaking moving forward. And yeah, Night of the Living Dead and Texas Chainsaw Massacre are by far the two most influential and groundbreaking horror films ever made in the 20th century. So, and The Birds is right next to, I think The Birds is in third place. But yeah, you can find me on Twitter. I run the Goomba Stomp Twitter account. You can find me over at Goomba Stomp Writing. I'm publishing an article about the return of the Obra Dinn tonight. So it will be live when the podcast gets released. You should check out the article. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook. Listen to us on Stitcher, Podbean, we're everywhere, iTunes. And leave us a rating if you like our show.
Yeah. And I am Tim Mason. You can find me at The Freemason, M-A-I-S-O-N, on Twitter. Check out my other show, Goomba. I almost said Goomba Stomp because I'm a little bit tired. Game Boys, all about co-op and multiplayer. We've been having a lot of fun celebrating Halloween with a horror month of our own. And it's been a blast. I can't wait for the final week. So check that out. And, of course, check out all of our work on Goomba Stomp. Again, like Rick said, give us a like and a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It does a lot of big things for us, and we really appreciate it. And, of course, tune in next week when we're back with All Things Nintendo. We'll talk to you then.
Thank you.